Thanks, Linda. I'm tall. Two LBs, we look very much alike, both published with Coach House. I've maybe just got like 4 inches or so difference, and different books. That was...
Just the 4 inches, that's all it really is.
The 4 inches is all that it really is. I might as well just sit down now. Two LBs, bye. Right, true. It is true. That was highly impressive. Well done. I can't wait to read it with the looking at the colors as well. I'm fascinated with synesthesia. Thanks to Deanna and Atwater Library for having this. She seems very excited. Last time I was here, I saw Heather O'Neill read. This was years and years ago. She said something that stuck with me and has given me a lot of permission as a writer, where she said she's still living with her father when she wrote her first novel, Lullabies for Little Criminals, it's called. Her father would leave for work in the morning, and she'd be sitting on the couch chain-smoking. Then when he got home from work, she'd still be on the couch chain-smoking. And he asked her, what have you been doing all day? And she's like, working. And that just, I was like, okay, it doesn't matter what anybody says. When I'm in bed in the morning with books, my notebook, and when they get home, it's the same, I'm working. It's true. Yeah. Anyway, I think I'm going to interject my readings with little anecdotes about writers that I've seen. So this first poem is from my first book, the title of which you can maybe ask about during the Q&A, because it's... longer story to get the Q&A started. It's always awkward. So this poem is loosely about walking. It's called Between Point A and Point B. What of the space between A and B? Zeno suggests infinity. Quantum Zeno. The dynamic evolution or motion of a quantum system can be hindered or inhibited through observation of the system. In other words, your observation inhibits my dynamic evolution. In other words, it is important to be alone. Observation incites opinion. Opinion encourages names. Names are made of language, and language is made of chains. A was her home, B was her school. At A, they appointed her with multiple names. At B, they appointed her with multiple names. Did she ask for these names? All these names don't get it. They don't get it, and she can't say it. So in the space between, she walked and looked and breathed and smelled until she was nothing but a staring problem, nothing but a nostril. She called this space perfect, the space between A and B, the space between two places that slapped names upon her and between two places upon which she slapped names. What violence this naming. While walking, she abandoned them. The anxiety of place beckons persona, shed whenever possible, the cadence of vanishing. Certain things occur when language is abandoned. There are no eyes to inhibit. Space takes on shimmer and fortissimo. The fact of its bigness makes one borderless. Language has limits. Language is linear, made of chains. Your task is to smell the morning, and there's nothing wrong with what you're wearing, and your hair is just fine, so notice the wild staccato and sinew of sound, from the loud to minute brush of dry grass. There is no violence or direction. Let's say it's lightly snowing, and every snowflake has the power of an extraterrestrial crystal palace of monumental healing and light, so who cares if your decisions have been correct? Know you, know you, know you. Even your family can betray you, but when there is no you, your family can't betray you. The place between A and B formally requests you drop the story. He is not better than you because there is no you, and you have not failed because there is no you. You did not say the wrong thing because there is no you. There was no humiliating sexual encounter because there is no you. You didn't detect bodily decay because there is no you. He cannot hurt you because there is no you. Your task is to walk among the 10,000 things. Look at the sky and become it. Smell the morning and become it. Feel the temperature and become it. Scatter with the wind. Not a name reaches you in your bassinet of nothingness strung between point A and point B. One is so layered. The sky is vast and will relieve each layer you release. Each turns into a fine mist that lifts. This is who you are, so they say, now let it go. Now this is who you are, so they say, now let it go. Now this is who you are, so they say, now let it go. Now this is who you are, so they say, now let it go. And finally, what's left but the gentle breath? And who says this bitch is anything but gentle? Let it go, what they say, let it go in the space between two places. It will take it, and you will see it was all nothing. And by that, I mean everything. In this space, you aren't forgiven because there is no you to forgive. So in that sense, you are forgiven. You can practice this in jail. It's very nice. It's very stylish. You and every annoying song you ever heard, just a wave, baby, just a wave. Don't worry, you're a great dancer. In between is not uninteresting. Trying to be interesting is not interesting. What destroys mediocrity? Sensitivity destroys mediocrity. That's what destroys mediocrity. Animals have awareness radically different than our own. This animal can fly, and this animal can see in the dark and lick its own eyeballs. And this animal has electromagnetic compasses in its eyeballs. And what was it you were saying about being interesting? If you are nothing, then no names stick. To be nothing is to say, I am not my face, but without saying it, just being faceless. The best thing about you, nobody can see anyway, so you might as well go out in the blue ocean in a blue boat and wear your finest blue suit. Oh yes, there you are, I can't see you. Is it raining? So, after I saw Heather O'Neill, I think the next sort of fangirl, or writer I'm a fangirl of, that I saw was Lydia Davis at Concordia. And after her reading, this linguist student asked one of those annoying questions that are, you know, you expect from a Q&A where they just love the sound of their own voice. It was this highly convoluted question full of linguistics jargon, and her answer after he had finished his like 10-minute question was just, I just like to abuse grammar, as her answer, which I also really took to heart for my future writing, because I do enjoy that without much of a theory behind it, except for that music of it. So I'm going to read from another section in this first book. It's called Men in Various States, and these men want to ventriloquize the male voice as a woman writer, and some of the less savory voices. because men have done that forever with women's voices. And these are unnamed men, and they're all in various states of confusion, except for this first one I'm going to read, which was initially called The Things Said in a Domestic Setting, but there is confusion in it. And it was literally written 5 minutes it happened in my real life. So. He says that she says that he said something he didn't say. She says that he says that she said something she didn't say. He says she says things when she means something else. She says he says mean things. He says she says he says mean things, and he says he does not say mean things. He says things that mean something, and he says she says things that don't mean anything. She says she can't believe he says she says things that don't mean anything, and that he says things that mean something, because what he actually says, she says, are mean things that mean things. He says she can only say he says mean things only if she lists the mean things he says, and if she can't list the mean things he says, then he simply says things that mean things. She says precisely because he says she must list the mean things means he says mean things. She says she can't list the mean things he means because she says he only says she only says things that don't mean anything. And she says that if she says things that don't mean anything, at least she says things that don't mean anything rather than saying things that mean things. He says he's sorry she thinks he says things that mean things, and that maybe she shouldn't invest such meaning in the things he means because he doesn't mean them. He says that yes, sometimes he says things that mean things just to be mean. He says, for example, he doesn't mean it when he says she says things that don't mean anything or mean something else. He is just saying those things to be mean. She says that what he says no longer has any meaning, no matter how mean, and she says she's not sure they've said anything that means anything anyway, so perhaps they should stop saying things and just make coffee, to which he happily agrees. So the next man I'm going to read, and these two men are very, very brief, based on a father of a XXX boyfriend. And can be characterized as such. His poem is, "How was I to know that after I married Helen, I would meet Lee? How was I to know that when I married Lee, I would meet Leah? How was I to know?" And the last man I'm gonna read is quoted directly from a friend of mine one time, and he meant it. Man number 9. My extent of knowledge about women is as follows. 1, watch your tone of voice. 2, I am irrational and a little bit crazy. 3, don't ever live with me. 4, you will never understand me, ever. That was his extent of knowledge about women. Okay. So I'm gonna read from my newest book, and on the Great Joke, from Coach House. I read this book recently with Lisa Robertson at Concordia, which was really fun. And after the reading, Lisa told me this story of this man following her behind her after a reading in Vancouver and just whispering, "Pretentious, pretentious," like the entire way. But she didn't love at the time, but like loves telling now. So the beginning of my book, I read this at the Concordia reading because I imagined, Lao Tzu applying for a teaching position at Concordia. And the first section of my book deals with the Tao Te Ching, a book that I've been mulling over since the age of 14. It was actually the first book I ever stole from Chapters. So I play with it in multiple ways, but this piece is how I imagine Lao Tzu, the supposed author of the Tao Te Ching, what he would say in an application letter to a university. To whom it may concern, and it is my hope that nobody is concerned. The class I do not propose to not teach is called Why Wu Why, Do Not Do, or alternatively called Nothing Much. The nature of the course is for students to practice the skills of being su, simple, plain, like raw silk, and pu, natural and honest, like uncut wood. Your institution is well known to be a place of higher education, so naturally in the course of the course, the students will seek to occupy the lowest place possible. If they are at a place, they are at the lowest place. If they are a taste, they are flat, tasteless, nothing much. In the spirit of Why Wu Why, I teach without teaching. For the first class, I am 20 miles away, gazing elsewhere. It is not possible to explain what it is to teach without teaching, or what it is to teach without teaching the concept of do not do. I can say this. Sometimes I will come to class with a clay pot. The lesson is called Where the Pot Is Not. It is said you can double the size of the universe by understanding where the pot is not. Hollowed out clay is where the pot is not, and where the pot is not is where it is most useful. My syllabus says this and this only. Need little, want less, forget the rules, be untroubled. Some students believe Wei Wu Wai is an easy credit. This is the belief of the ever-wanting soul who sees only what it wants to see. They do not understand what self-discipline is required to align themselves with the way rather than with their own nature. Why Wu Why is counterintuitive and counter-institutional. It takes a great effort to achieve effortlessness, and it often takes the entire semester for the students to merely comprehend that they do not comprehend effortlessness. The way is paradoxical, and paradoxes allow us to apprehend the mystery of which we are part. It is neither correct or incorrect to say that YWY is a finishing school for death. How to die without resistance, how to enter the stream to flow. The end of the course is called Understanding the Corpse. That is, to understand that the body comes to its ending, but there is nothing to fear. Endings occur, but sometimes endure, but something endures, and what endures is the way. To be sure, be pliant and supple while alive, as stiffness and strictness are for the dead. For the lesson to bear and not to own, I assign complicated, time-intensive papers. On the due date of the great papers, I ask the students to hand their papers to the right. The person to the right is to erase the name and replace it with their own, and it is for that paper they shall receive the grade. I tell them this will double the size of the universe. Not praising the praiseworthy keeps people uncompetitive. This exercise is not to cherish altruism, which is merely the other side of egoism. Students learn, like nature, to be selfless, absent of positive, ethical, or political values. When the self is let go, all that is left is what the soul needs. The successful students, the unwanting souls who rid themselves of their grades, will see what is hidden, while the unsuccessful students, the ever-wanting souls who do not part with their grades, will see only what they want. To do good, work well, lie low. The pedagogical non-approach of YWY angers university students who demand a certain type of exact instruction, which is all university students. In accordance with their desires, I assign very complicated texts. The texts, however, have nothing to do with the class. At the end of each week, I hand out marks which the student are free to trade with each other. If those with high marks are willing to trade with those with low marks, or if those with low marks are content with their low marks and content with others having high marks, or if those with the high marks do not relate to their high marks and regard those with low marks as high markers, the class is well on the way. This is the mysterious power. Of student absences, I accept excuses such as, I took a very long walk, or I was sweeping my floor, or I was on my way, then I went another way. Or, I did not leave my room since it's the inner eye that really sees the world. The end of term assessment is as follows. Is the student always alert like a cat's ears? Is the student always polite and quiet like a butler? Is the student always elusive like mist? Is the student always blank like fresh snow? Is the student always empty like where the pot is not? Effortlessly, Lao Tzu. So the final, I didn't bring a clock, I think one more piece is sufficient, or more than. I'm changing what I was going to read last, actually. Peppered throughout the text are these short films that were initially recurring dreams I had, and I imagined them as films, and then imagined how they could work in this book, and there's an essay about them at the very, very back of the book, if you choose to look past the acknowledgments. I haven't thrown the book across the room yet. So this is short film 4. A woman in her early 30s is shown performing all the rhythmic, banal things any human being does unselfconsciously throughout the day, such as brushing teeth, tripping in the legs of her underwear, peeing, splashing water over her face, leaning on the counter while drinking orange juice out of the carton, staring into space, combined with small disembodied shots, such as her wrist wrenching the espresso filter handle, slipping her foot into her shoe, and so on. The director has full creative license over what banal tasks are shown and in what sequence. However, there are four crucial things that must be included. The first, the film begins with the woman in bed in the morning. She opens her eyes, stares for a solid 5 seconds, then cue the blaring sound of an air horn. The first blast should be sustained. It is important that the woman does not react to the sound. Instead, unblinking, she continues to stare, then rubs her eyes, stretches, rubs her face, gets out of bed, and makes the bed. The air horn does stop intermittently, but only intermittently. Some blasts are brief, others not. Some silences are brief, others not. What is important is that she does not react to the air horn. 2. The horn must blare at in intervals throughout the entire film. The juxtaposition of what tasks the woman performs and horn blast lengths are entirely up to the director. If choreographed well, a subtle humor should become apparent. The director must treat the duration of this film as a psychological test. The ideal duration should be the amount of time it takes for half the audience to leave. Whatever the duration of the film, enough time should be allotted to portray an even spectrum of an average day's activities and end with the final scene, where, 3, the woman calmly slips into her tidy bed. She closes her eyes. The horn blares for a good 10 seconds longer, then stops. The remaining audience members will be rewarded with a final 30 seconds of watching the woman sleep peacefully, the only sound being her gentle breath. 4, the film is called On Grief. The title must be shown only at the end when the final scene cuts out. The credits may be shown in silence or may be accompanied by music that, no matter what, from Bach to the Beach Boys, will be absurd. Or better, perhaps, instead of music, a sustained cheering stadium audience track is played. Director's choice. So, okay.